cat up, died of fright, thought she crossed his path last night. I got a woman, mean as she can be. Sometimes I think she's almost mean as me. Kissed so hard, she bruised my lips, hurt so good, my heart is split. I got a woman, mean as you can be. Sometimes I think she's almost mean. Strangest gal I ever met, never happy unless she's mad. I got a woman, mean as she can be. Sometimes I think she's almost mean as me. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. She makes love without a smile. Hot dog, it drives me wild. I got a woman mean as she can be. Sometimes I think she's almost mean as me. Sometimes I think she's almost mean as me.
There we go, boys and girls. That was at the Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern last night, where Tommy took the stage and sang one song. Only sang that a couple of times in the past, but I sort of like that one. I think I'm gonna sing that more often. Okay, Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse right here in Warsaw, near Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, and it's the box number PO401. Did I say that? I don't know. I forget what I said. Okay, let's go here. It is December the 9th, and we're moving towards winter solstice, and also the birth of the sun, which all good Aryans should celebrate, because we revere the sun. We don't worship the sun, but I think all races down through history have at one time worshiped the sun, except the Jews, who at one time worshiped the moon. Those boys just got to be different, I'll tell you. Yeah, and it's says still a full moon. Now, that's been full moon about 4 days. I think that my clock may be a little... The Frank Silva Memorial Atomic Clock, that should be starting to go away, that full moon. But we couldn't see it the last couple of nights anyhow, because it was clouded over big time. Yeah, I like to sing karaoke. I've been singing karaoke since about 1991, I think, around 1990, 91, back in there sometime. That's a long time, and I ain't got a damn bit better about that, but I have a lot of fun singing. And most of the places I go, they seem to like it, and they seem to like it pretty much. C.O. Bomsky is telling us he's going to straighten all this mess out, and the more he... gets into it, the more he pushes race. And I don't care how they talk about race, just as long as they talk about race, good, bad, or indifferent, as long as they keep it on their mind. And now with all the progressives doing a great job for us, promoting the idea of race, and promoting a whole lot of lies about people and race, it's pissing a lot of people off out there. I'm starting to get quite a bit more email in from disgruntled people, man. And that's what we want. We want people to get madder and madder and madder and madder. They don't have to go down on the street and march around. They just have to do things to make it right, baby. I see they tacked onto the military appropriations bill, which a god-awful, you know, what is it, a third or a half of our GNP for war and building weapons. And most of those weapons will never be used. Ships that won't be used much. And planes that are outmoded before they even get out on the field. Yeah, a congressman up here about 40 miles from me, he's put in a rider into that appropriations bill to try and help the guys who are committing suicide. You know, what do they say, 2,000, 3,000, maybe more committed suicide. That's the ones we know of, you know. And so anyhow, that's getting worse. And, of course, the only answer to that is bring the troops home. If you don't want people committing suicide and doing crazy things, bring them home. It's very simple. But now they're talking about, now they're sending 1,000 more guys over there. Stupido. Hey, boy, you dumb.
You dumb boy.
You're going to serve the corporations, man. Corporations don't appreciate you, man. Except if you get a leg blowed off the local splint manufacturer here in town will make you a new pair of thighs and knees and stuff like that. They like that, man. You're really helping their stock.
Well, I see a man at a protest against police brutality in Berkeley, California, was knocked out with a hammer on Sunday night after he tried to stop looters. Disturbing footage of the incident was captured on camera by a Berkeley reporter, Emilio Ragusa. The brief video shows a man in a bicycle helmet pushing protesters wearing black hoodies outside a Radio Shack on Satic Avenue in Berkeley. One of the protesters then smashes a hammer into the man's head and he drops to the ground. Well, there you go. The protesters that protest police brutality are getting brutal themselves. Interesting.
Well, Stephen Colbert got the Emperor Obama on his show, and he asked him some embarrassing questions. I'll tell you what. Let's see here. If I get this straightened out here, we'll do it.
And it's the right thing to do.
Whoops. Try it again here.
The good
morning
is capturing the moment.
Well, let's talk about the jobs out there and how many of them will be taken by all the immigrants you're going to keep in this country. You realize you're an emperor now. It has been declared. You are Barakus Maximus the First. I'm a Christian. Would you like to throw me to the lions? I would be delicious. Why did you burn the Constitution and become an emperor?
You know, actually, Stephen, everything that we have done is scrupulously within the law and has been done by previous Democratic and Republican presidents. Congress passes laws. We're supposed to execute them. When it comes to immigration laws, in the same way that Ronald Reagan and the two Bush presidents did, we have to make decisions. We've got a certain amount of enforcement resources. Who is it that we're going after? Are we going after...
Weren't those two previous decisions in the wake of laws that had been passed, but they changed the implementation of those laws? This is just you saying, I declare.
No, actually, Stephen, what happened in those situations was Congress passed laws, and then Congress deliberately left out some things the president wanted, but they still thought it was the right thing to do.
But laws are like jazz. It's the parts you don't pass.
Here's what's going on. You went from the sort of Caesar metaphor to the jazz metaphor, and I got all confused. So
all right.
We're going to bring it back to
right,
immigration.
We
can't deport 11 million folks who are here, the vast majority of whom are good people who are just trying to get ahead and try to make sure their families get ahead. So instead of devoting a whole lot of resources on separating families, grabbing some mom who's working in a hotel or some dad who's working in a kitchen somewhere and separating them out, let's focus on deporting felons. Let's focus on strengthening the border.
I can't take any more of this, boys and girls. Well, the New York police shot and killed a man on early Tuesday who had stabbed a person in the head inside of a Brooklyn synagogue, police said. Police responded to the scene at 1:40 a.m. Eastern Time and found a 49-year-old suspect
with a knife in hand, and the New York Police Department said in a statement giving the address as 770 Eastern Parkway, the world headquarters of the Shabbat Lubavitch movement. Officers demanded that he drop the knife, which he did, before picking it back up and moving towards the officers. An officer shot once, hitting the man in his torso and fatally wounding him. I wonder what that was all about. Another angry Lubavitcher? Well, I had the video on that. I might send it along to you, but it was very interesting, this virtual fight between the cops and a nigger in a synagogue. And everybody's going crazy. Yeah, man, that's the way they do, you know. Crown Heights, I think it is. That's where this, Crown Heights. When I was there one time going down into Brooklyn to the to see something of historical value, I noticed that there were, every cop car had four police in it, four officers in it, and I saw them on doorsteps down through the area of Brooklyn there, and there was four or five cops at somebody's door. I mean, you know, it's something else in Brooklyn. Well, they're all upset that the dirty linen of the CIA is going to come out, and it came out at 11 o'clock today, I believe. And that upsets them. They don't ever like themselves to be put against the wall. The CIA is one of the most dangerous agencies in this country. Let's listen to what this really pro-CIA people and pro-Republican and all that on the CIA report is going to say. Okay, let's go here.
All right, joining us now, KT McFarland, Fox News national security analyst, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. All right, KT, your reaction, first of all, on the timing of this release. There's been so much back and forth, and today it comes despite continued objections. And at one time, the objections were coming from the White House. The White House now seems okay with the disclosure. What do you make of it?
Well, there are two things. One is, okay, one thing to actually investigate and do the report. There's another issue, which is, why make the report public? Why make the report public now? There should be one major rule in foreign policy, like in medicine: first, do no harm.
We want to know. That's why you make it public,
you bitch. Another thing to do harm by releasing the report publicly.
All right, we have in the past been told, and some Democratic lawmakers have admitted, that they were briefed on these things years and years ago. Yeah. And we all remember the days after 9/11 when people were afraid. There was some unity about going after these guys and getting the intelligence that we could. The report is now saying the intelligence didn't really help. These enhanced interrogation techniques didn't really take us anywhere. There are plenty of folks saying, yes, they did. I mean, and they're pointing to specific instances of where those interrogations actually led to actionable intelligence. Your
torture is wonderful.
Well, the report is making two claims. One, what was done was illegal. No, it wasn't. The legal advice at the time to the Americans who were conducting these investigations
legal is what
was,
we
yeah,
say
it
is legal.
And as you point out, it was done in the aftermath of September 11th. I watched those Twin Towers come down. I live in New York. We assumed there was another attack coming imminently. The second thing is, what was the intelligence gathered? Was it effective? Look, we've had three former directors of the CIA, deputy directors of the CIA, people involved in the hunt for Osama bin Laden. They have all said that they got a lot of intelligence from this. So it was legal. It was effective. Why go after it now? Unless...
Well, what she's telling you is that they want to keep it secret. The CIA wants everything secret. They want to be able to torture people anywhere they torture them. And given the chance, they'll torture you or me, or have somebody else do it for them, maybe the FBI or Homeland Security. So of course they want everything kept secret, torturing people all over the world in wars we shouldn't even be in, have no business in. Well, there is business to them. It's all business. It's all about selling arms and big corporations and all that, but it's no good for you or me, boy. Well, I see my old nemesis that I've debated a couple of times on national TV, Montel Williams, the mulatto with earrings in his ears, and he loves white women. I think he's married to a white woman. Anyhow, he tried without success on Monday to get a group of Fox News hosts to have an honest discussion about why race was at the heart of the protests over the recent killings of black men by police.
Well, I think I agree with Montel. Let's see what's going on here. Outnumbered began its Monday coverage of the protest over a grand jury's decision not to indict New York City police officer who killed Eric Garner by showing white rioters in Berkeley, California, following a video clip of President Barack Obama talking about racism within law enforcement. Quote, what do people in the streets want? Fox News host Harris Faulkner wondered. Williams pointed out that Fox News had shown a clip of Occupy protesters rioting in California and suggested they needed to start having a real discussion about race. We just don't do it, he explained. We keep pointing at other directions, blaming other people. Well, that's right. Let's get it out there. Let's get all the hypocrites on both sides out there. You know, both sides are full of hypocrites. And as far as hundreds of these whites that are running out on the street, mostly students, dumber than a rock, demonstrating in this deal, they don't have a dog in the fight. You know? They really don't. They think they do because they're standing up for the Constitution, all that bullshit. Here you go with the Christian fanatics again. A U.S. man has been arrested in Israel on suspicion of preparing attacks on Muslim holy sites, police said Tuesday. The arrest came amid tensions between Jews and Arabs in Jerusalem over the access of the Al-Quissa Mosque compound, located in the Israeli-occupied east of the city and holy to both Judaism and Islam. The man, identified as Adam Everett Livix and said to be a Christian and a native of Texas, born in 1984, has been charged with possession of weapons and being in the country illegally. Quote, Shin Bet, internal security and police arrested an American citizen on November 19th who was illegally in Israel for possession of weapons and planning terrorist attacks, statement said. Well, there you go. Those some of those Hagee Christians down there getting excited. They're going over there and attack the Arabs in Israel. Jeez. Oh, man, what a crazy time, man. Well, let's get back into our book Exiles from History, about the Jews by David McCollum. And let's read about Jews and sex. And away we go. The subject of sex has been a focus for Jewish writers since biblical times. The Babylonian Talmud, which is the legal code that forms the basis of Jewish regulations, contains many references to sexual mores and commentaries. Many of these regulations are perverse. For example, Yavohamoth 55b permits sexual intercourse with a dead relative, whether the relative was single or married. Kenaboth 11b advocates sex with three-year-old girls. Sanhedrin 54b, 55a permits sodomy with three-year-old girls and boys under nine. I hope I didn't read this before. 78A of the same book allows sodomy with a dying person, but only so long as the act is committed in the presence of a rabbi. Lengthy debates take place within the holy books about whether or not consumption or consummation of a marriage on the Sabbath would constitute work. The lawmakers concluded that such intercourse is not work and is permissible because any act of damage does not constitute labor in regard to the Sabbath. You know, I think I read this before. I'm going to go to the next item. Since here's an item of great interest, the Holocaust, I'm going to skip to that. Like, who cares? Holocausts, we're told, are nothing new to the Jews. They have been suffering regular extermination programs since time began. The first, the Egyptians and the Persians, then the Romans, then the Spanish, then the Russians, then the Nazis, and today the Arabs. As the candid Jewish historian Dr. Howard F. Stein wrote in the Journal for Historical Review in the winter of 1980, Quote, for the Jews, the term Holocaust does not simply denote a single catastrophic era in history, but is a grim metaphor for the meaning of Jewish history. The Holocaust lies at the heart of the Jewish experience of time itself. One is either anxiously awaiting persecution, experiencing persecution, recovering from persecution, or living in a period that is temporary reprieve from it. Holocaust is thus the timeless fabric into which the 1933-45 period is woven. Thus, the reality of the Holocaust is inextricably part of the myth in which it is woven, and for which myth it serves as further confirmation evidence for the timeless Jewish theme that the world is in conspiracy to annihilate them, one way or another, at least eventually. Indeed, the Jewish perception of many of these Holocausts is strikingly synchronous. We can trace the same features in all of them: persecution by the anti-Semites, gassing or burnings, sexual and toiletry tortures, the general Jewish suffering and torment. The myth tells us more about the tellers than about the subject characters, for many of these tales are totally or partly fictitious. They do not stand up to scientific examination. Let us start at the beginning of the alleged plot by the Persian Prime Minister Haman to exterminate the Jewish population. Every year, modern Jews still celebrate Haman's execution in a festival known as Purim, which involves eating pies cooked in the form of human ears. The legend tells us that Haman's plot was foiled when the king took a Jewish bride, Esther, in place of his current queen, Vashti. Esther was advised by her cousin Mordecai of the Haman plot to kill Persia's entire Jewish population, and so she prevailed upon her husband, the king, to execute Haman and his 10 sons and some tens of thousands of his followers. However, we read in the Encyclopedia Judaica under Purim, quote, the chronological difficulties, such as the identity of King Ahasuerus and absence of any references to a Persian source to a king having a Jewish consort, the striking resemblance between the names Mordecai and Esther to the Babylonian gods Merodach and Ishtar, the lack of any reference to Purim in the Jewish literature before the 1st century B.C., the language of the Book of Esther would suggest a later date. All of these have been moved the critics to look elsewhere than the account of Esther for the true origin of the festival. Various conjectures have been made, but the problem still awaits its solution. Esther, or Ishtar, was a Jewish fertility goddess to whom firstborn Jewish children were sacrificed by their parents. She was part of a pantheon of gods that included Moloch, the fire god, in whose fiery Auschwitzian statue more Jewish babies were burned alive. In numerous biblical Old Testament passages, we find heated debate and condemnation of this practice. However, Jewish parents do not physically sacrifice their children to the altar of Jewish theology. Modern Jewish parents just inculcate sufficient guilt, anxiety, and worry into their offspring that the destruction of their psychological self-esteem is a much more punitive and therefore valuable offering. In other words, make them paranoid all the time. Jewish Talmudic literature offers all sorts of outlandish claims for Jewish casualties in various Jewish revolts against the Roman rule. The revolt in 115 to 117 AD started in Libya and spread along the coast to Egypt and then to Cyprus. However, in most cases, the Jews did not attack the Roman administrator or soldiers. They attacked the Greek and Roman civilians. Hundreds of thousands were massacred in response. The Roman army started killing Jews, and the Talmud tells us that in Alexandria, the casualty toll was 60 myriads, This would appear to be a total of 1,200,000, a rather remarkable figure since Alexandria's only had a total Gentiles and Jewish population of some 500,000 people in the whole town. According to the Old Testament, when the Jews were living in exile in Babylon, they eagerly worshipped the Babylonian pagan gods. One of these, Moloch, was a fire god, and consequently firstborn Jewish babies were burned alive by the way of placating the sacrifice. The next Jewish revolt was in 132 to 135 under the self-proclaimed Messiah Bar Kokhba. According to the Talmud, the revolt ended in the Romans laying siege to Bar Kokhba's fortress at Bethar near Jerusalem. We're told that Bar Kokhba was so tough that he would kick catapulted Roman rocks back at them with his knee. Question: if the Jews were being persecuted so badly, why would they allow this guy, this Jew, to build this big fortress? The Romans finally captured the fortress and in revenge killed 4 billion, or as some say, 40 million Jews, in order to reassure us of the authenticity of these figures. The Talmud tells us that a tidal wave of Jewish blood carrying large boulders with it stained the sea for a distance of 4 miles out. Oh, man. The Jewish school children in Bethar, all 64 million, or as some say 150,000, were rolled up eventually, individually, in their parchment scrolls and burned alive. Slain Jews were used as fence posts. I lived on a farm, and I still live out here on the farm. A body wouldn't make much of a fence post. The blood left over from the tidal wave was used to fertilize Roman vineyards for the next 7 years. Needless to say, the Roman literature of the time does not even mention any massacre in Bethar. Credulity prevents us from accepting the Talmudic massacre allegations and their death toll, but we do detect a certain amount of synchronicity between these ancient yarns and the modern Nazi Holocaust allegations. As regards the Spanish Inquisition, we have already seen how the chief inquisitor and burner of Jews at the stake, Fray Thomas de Torquemada, was himself a Jew whose father had feigned conversion to Christianity. Torquemada enrolled the assistance of pious pamphleteer Fray Alfonso de Espina in his rabble-rousing activities against the Protestants, Jews, and other non-Catholics. Espina, besides being a flaming homosexual, was yet another Marrano, or Jewish pretend convert. Torquemada's successor, Fray Diego de Deza, was also a Christianized Jew. So here again, the Jews can hardly complain about a Spanish Holocaust when it was in fact other Jews who were doing the persecuting and the Jew burning. If anyone has a complaint, it is surely the Protestants, who were tortured and murdered both by Catholics and the Jews pretending to be Catholics. Some Jews have argued that the recitation of the Kol Nidre, or breaking of all vows on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, was necessitated by Jews being forced to adopt Christianity during this period. Of course, Kol Nidre was in regular use long before that. Before the Nazi monster came on the scene, the main character of the Jewish pantheon of demons was the Tsar, and his regular pogroms against innocent Jews. However, try this one. There is no academic authentication that such pogroms ever took place. In fact, the Western diplomats who investigated such allegations at the time found that the massacre stories were a pack of lies. Oxford University historian Goldwin Smith found that British consuls visited the sites of alleged pogroms and found there was nothing of the sort had taken place. What had happened was that the Russian workers had rioted against Jewish moneylenders, and the Tsarist troops were called in to quell the Russians, which they did. Various British diplomats in Russia at the time fully acknowledged that the Jews were resented by the workers and peasants, not because of their creed, but because of their loan sharking and sharp business practices. American writers also note that the Jewish predilection for usury in Russia. Mark Twain had various scathing remarks to make. So too did Portney Bigelow, who wrote for Harper's Magazine. The Russian intellectuals also held the rampant Jewish capitalism was solely responsible for anti-Jewish feeling. Alexander Pushkin, including several unattractive Jewish usurers in his works, as did the lesser-known Nikolai Gogol and Dmitri Rasenikov. A Russian authoress living in America, Zinaid Rogozin, attempted to present a correct perspective of the program tales in the prestigious Century magazine, April 1882. In a hard-to-find book, Diary of a Writer, the famed Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky wrote that the Jews are draining the soil of Russia. Of course, we cannot leave a survey of the Jewish persecution in Tsarist Russia without mentioning the case of our dear friend Lev Davidovich Trotsky, or Bronstein, to use his correct name. In his autobiography, My Life, he tells us that on his father's estate, the workers received no shelter, no meat, and but 10 rubles a month for heavy labor. When they started to deteriorate physically, his father would give them some watermelons or half a sack of dried fish, and they would go back to work again, often singing. In the book Trotsky by Francis Whedon and King David King, we learn that Trotsky was so persecuted that he was sent off to a Tony prep school in the Russian resort of Odessa, plunging into the largely Jewish radical chic fraternity life. Trotsky and company quickly set about hatching plots to redirect all the peasant resentment against Jewish capitalists into the peasant resentments against the Tsar. When they finally succeeded in having the Tsar deposed, popular unrest in the spring of 1917, who should be waiting in the wings but Trotsky and his crowd of Jewish radicals? Several months later, the popular democratic government was overthrown by a tiny bunch of Jewish agitators. And most of those were from the United States, Brooklyn, in fact. And the Jewish power was finally in total control of the reins of power. Now they could set about really ripping off the Russian workers, since there was no czar to apply a modicum of regulation. Deals were struck with wealthy Jewish capitalists in the West, such as Arm & Hammer, whereby Russian minerals and Russian labor would be ruthlessly exploited for the mutual benefit of the Jewish capitalists in the West and the Jewish state capitalists in the Soviet Union. What greater profit base could there be than a country where the labor force was captive of the government? The always upward, socially mobile Jewish landlords and loan sharks merely exchanged their snazzy civilian clothes for commissars' uniforms. The surviving Holocaust has become something of a Jewish tradition. There is no greater survival industry than that related to the 33-45 period, when 6 million Jews are supposed to have been done to death by the Nazi government of Germany. Again, these claims have been scrupulously examined by academics such as Dr. Arthur Butts of Northwestern University at Chicago, Dr. Robert Forison of the University of Lyon in France, and have found to be unsupported. The California-based Institute for Historical Review publishes many books and quarterlies, journals on historical review, which debunk such outlandish claims. Naturally, the IHR is a subject of much Jewish and Jewish-inspired pogrom, as were those who expressed the slightest skepticism over earlier Jewish Holocaust claims. Yeah, they burnt their warehouse down. In this Holocaust to end all Holocausts, the same features are evident as before. The similarity of the gas chambers and the gas ovens to Moloch's fiery furnace than to the burning of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is uncanny. The exaggeration of causality figures beyond the democratic possibilities is the same with the 6 million as, let's see here, hold it, as it was with Bar Kokhba's 64 million. The heavy lacing of the narratives with sexual and toiletry torments is synchronistic. We also find many references to rats and dogs eating Jewish flesh, which brings to mind the biblical accounts of street dogs licking up the blood of Jezebel. Let us examine a few such narratives. The New York Times of 4 June 1974 reported on a Holocaust symposium held at the curious locale of St. John's Catholic Church in Manhattan. The reporter, Israel Schenker, recounted an entire rap sheet of Nazi crimes described in the symposium by survivors, by experts. The corpses of Jews were trundled to the ovens in wheelbarrows, he tells us. No water was available to the prisoners. All had to drink mud. Grandparents held hands with the children while going into the ovens. Hateful police dogs ate pieces of flesh alive, and rats, too, ate up the cheeks of the bodies. Mud is often cited in psychoanalysis as a symbol for excreta, or shit. Walking into a horizontal crematory furnace is not physically possible. Of course, the narrator is drawing on the biblical imagery outlined earlier. Dogs and rats eat one's face is more likely the symptom of a deep neurosis than it is an empirical reality. One woman recounted, quote, "Then they sent us to Birkenau, into the mud, where there was fleas and dirt. We had no water at all. We drank mud. I had malaria, I had typhus, I had everything. But it happened that my heart kept on beating in spite of it. You don't manage to survive it, it just happens. My brother died in the camp. My mother was sent to Auschwitz at the same time. I saw this big fire, and I knew my mother's body was burning. And I was grateful that she should not have to see the burning in front of her or know what I saw her burning in the front of me." Professor Irving Greenberg of the City of University of New York also spoke about the burning, but in a more theological sense. He felt that Jews must philosophically learn to expect periods of belief interspersed with times when the flames and smoke of their burning children blot out the faith, though it flickers again. The symbol of the regeneration of Jewish life through the burning or other sacrificing of Jewish children is one we have already encountered in our examination of ancient Jewish sacrificial offerings to the fertility goddess Ishtar and the fire god Moloch. We also recall that when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were tossed into the fiery furnace by an enemy king, he was promptly astounded to discover not just that the three Israelites walked around in the flames unscathed, but a fourth figure, the Jewish Son of God, in there with them. We have seen the symbol recycled in the Talmudic accounts of Jewish children being burnt in their own Torah scrolls by the Romans. Almost every day when one picks up a newspaper, one reads survivor accounts of the Holocaust, which include such Talmudic symbolism. In the University of Tulsa Collegian, dated 11 February 1982, we read of a lecture by Jack Glosser, yet another survivor of Auschwitz, who says, quote, "He will never forget his work on the crew that was responsible for burying babies alive. It was not until the most inhumane thing ever done by this man, who says, 'I probably couldn't kill a chicken if I had to.' It also marked the only time he viewed a Nazi act with compassion." There was a Nazi sergeant guarding us as we buried live babies, Glosser said in his Polish-accented English. All of a sudden, he pulled a grenade from his belt and tossed it into the ditch. Then a superior officer walked by and told him that the next time he did something like that, disciplinary actions would be taken. I had a cousin who had a three-month-old daughter on the train we took to Auschwitz, Glosser remembers. When we arrived at Auschwitz, the child was grabbed by a Nazi soldier and thrown on top of a pile of burning babies. Other parts of the Talmud are recalled when we study various descriptions of excremental assault, a survey of which appears in the Terence de Praesthesis, The Survivor. Quote, everybody in the block had syphilis. It came to Bergen-Belsen in its most violent, most painful, deadliest form. The diarrhea caused it by it became uncontrollable. It flooded the bottom of the cages, dripped through the cracks in the faces of the women lying in the cages below, and the mixed with blood, pus, urine, formed a slimy, fetid mud on the floor of the barracks. Here we go with the mud again. But the only bodily emission that does not get a look in this is semen, a vat which Jesus was boiled in, according to the Talmud. The wicked Nazis even tormented their captives by providing only one latrine for 30,000 to 32,000 women. This inadequacy yet again causes the Jews to foul each other for, quote, we stood in line to get into this tiny building, knee-deep in human excrement, as we all suffered from dysentery. We could rarely wait until our turn came and soiled our ragged clothes, which never came off our bodies. Even the luckier inmates who worked in the camp hospital had to step into human shit, into urine soaked with blood, into stools of patients suffering from highly contagious diseases, and some of the patients died before they ever reached the gas chambers. Many of them were covered all over with excrement, for there were no sanitary facilities. Having just one latrine for all those 30,000 prisoners, apparently, because the inmates to resort to unconventional toilets. That's 30,000 people, one toilet. That's bullshit. Many women with diarrhea relieved themselves in soap bowls or pans of coffee. Then they hid the utensils under the mattress to avoid the punishment threatened to them for doing so. 25 strokes on the bare buttocks, or kneeling all night long on sharp gravel, holding up bricks. These punishments often ended in the death of the guilty. Des Prez scoffs at attempts by the Jewish psychoanalysis to describe the camp experience as a reversion to infantile or anal fixation levels. He explains that in a deprived environment, it is only normal to focus totally on food and excrement. He points out that infants are not forced to wet and soil themselves, whereas prisoners had no other choice. If they attempted to go to a proper laboratory, they would be attacked by guard dogs or assaulted by guards. He goes on to describe various depraved tortures that the guards would inflict. Prisoners would be forced to urinate into each other's mouths. Soap bowls would be tossed into latrines. At Bergenwald, 10 prisoners suffocated in excrement pits in October 1937 alone. Unfortunately, none of these allegations stands up to scientific scrutiny. At Auschwitz today, one can still see the remarkable recreation facilities provided for the prisoners, including a swimming pool, a soccer field, a sports stadium, a volleyball court, and a theater. Hygiene was very strictly regulated, with all incoming internees being processed through the delousing facility that involved the fumigation of their clothes in fumigation closets, hence the so-called gas chambers. At various sites, British POWs were used to assist in the delousing process. A report by one of the POWs appeared in the Journal for Royal Army Medical Corps in September 1946. It is quite true that later in the war there were more serious outbreaks of typhus in many of the camps, but this was due to the outbreak of the bombing campaigns. Evacuees were coming in from the east, where typhus was epidemic. Thousands of Germans, including camp staff, died of this disease. It was not something the Germans would encourage through inadequate hygiene. On the contrary, it was something that they would rigorously try to stamp out. Posters in German and in Polish were posted everywhere advising of the fatal dangers of louse infestation. One of the most telling cases of survival fantasy is that of Kitty Hart, whose experience as an inmate were described in the Yorkshire television program Kitty Returned to Auschwitz, shown on British television in November 1979 and on American PBS stations a year later. The TV dialogue with her son at the remains at Auschwitz went like this. Quote, Kitty, if you didn't have your bowl, you didn't have your soup. If you didn't have your bowl, you wouldn't have your toilet, because your bowl was your toilet. Do you understand? Son, how did you wash the bowl out? Kitty, you didn't. Son, before you ate. Kitty, I mean you didn't. You didn't. You didn't wash it out. That was your life, your bowl. My bowl. It was red. Later, now I know, David, you're seeing grass, but I don't see any grass. I see mud, a sea of mud. Believe me, there was one blade. One blade of grass, you know, would have happened. You'd have eaten it. Then just a little while later, we find Kitty lying on a complete lawn of grass. This time seems resisting the impulse to start grazing. Quote, it was a glorious summer, so during the day I sat here on this lawn sunbathing, and we were laughing and joking. I was lying here, and I was watching the crematoria over there. You saw the SS man, the extermination squad, that did the actual killing, you know, the actual gassing. So somewhere there was a ladder. You could see it when you were lying here. And these SS men climbed up the ladder with a tin of gas, which they had in their hand, and through the skylight, he just dropped it in, this tin. Then he came down and off he went. And then a few seconds later, you heard a sort of muffled sound, and those were people actually suffocating. And then all of a sudden, it was quiet again. And then soon after, you lay here, and you could actually see smoke coming out of the chimney, and those were the very people that were burning. And do you think I could believe that there were people actually burning in there? I couldn't believe it. Can you hear, believe it? No. But people were burning there, and you could hear them screaming, but you still couldn't believe it. People were being sent in one at a time, and there were ashes at the other end 10 minutes later. 10 minutes later to burn a body? I don't think so. And this guy climbs up on the roof and just pours a poison to, what's the name of that stuff? I got it on the tip of my tongue. Pours it through a hole in the roof. Shit. Yeah, you know, it's amazing how gullible everybody is on this subject. Kitty also reveals that she was one of those odd folk in Auschwitz who washed in her own urine. Throughout the film, she continues, returns to urine and mud and bread. She's either bathing in urine, eating her own excrement, encrusted bowl, swimming in a sea of mud, or eating mouthfuls of bread. We know right away that something's wrong. Asphyxiated, stone-dead people do not scream when they are cremated. Bodies cannot be reduced to ashes in 10 minutes. A more reasonable time would be 2 to 3 hours. Oh, it's actually more than that. It's usually, I think, 4 to 7 hours, especially with the techniques they had back then. And that's how you can figure it out. Just start doing some multiplying and adding and dividing, and you can figure it out real quick. It's impossible for that to have happened. It would have taken 100 years to do what they claim. If she would munch on one blade of grass at the sea of mud, how come she could sunbathe on an entire lawn? The city is sorely in need of some good counseling to determine the underlying causes of her fixations on anal functions. Perhaps her childhood toilet training was too strict, and she subconsciously feels that opening her bowels without permission will lead to dire punishment, asphyxiation, and burning. Another survivor, whose attic is full of junk, is one Fania Fennellan, the subject of an American TV docudrama, Playing for Time. The TV production caused a storm of controversy because the anti-Zionist actress Vanessa Redgrave was cast in a lead role. In the case of Mrs. Fennellan's book of similar title, we are only on page one of her narrative before she tells us that, quote, "A trick I found to cool myself was to wash in my own urine. Keeping myself clean was essential to me, and there was nothing unclean about urine. I could drink it if I was thirsty, and I had done so." With inmates going around drinking their own urine and using their soap dishes as toilets, it would be hardly surprising that Auschwitz suffered from epidemics of disease. But it is rather more likely that these narratives are largely based on fantasy. Many of the survivors' accounts have appeared on the pulp paperback market over the years. In the early 1950s, there was a vogue for such material, but this had largely died out by the 1970s. However, the increased use of the Holocaust is justification for Israeli imperialism and exemption from normal moral criteria brought about a revival in the market. The showing of the television docudrama Holocaust did much to heighten interest, and of course the Zionists were quick to use the opportunity to draw attention to the alleged correlation between the Nazi Holocaust and the existence of a Jewish theocratic colony in the Mideast. Many survivors sought to jump on the bandwagon, and by 1980 there were scores of personal testimonies flooding the bookstores. None of these were of any academic nature, and some of them were downright fiction from beginning to end. But still, one could detect the same symbols and the same neuroses exhibiting in themselves. One particularly trashy novel of the era was Eyewitness to Auschwitz, 3 years in the Gas Chambers by Philip Mueller. Mueller's book is full of low-budget horror movie material that would be laughed out of court in any test of authenticity. He claims the SS doctors would examine victims while they were still alive, and once they were gassed, would slice off bits of flesh for experiments, the flesh jumping around in a bucket. He claimed to have waded through pits of decomposed corpses, which oozed up out of the ground one hot summer. On one page, a female gassee does a strip tease to distract attention. During the mayhem, Mueller gets locked into the gas chamber, but miraculously escapes. On a later page, the chief gasser, Maul, gets sexually turned on, as does his dog, which the killing of another beautiful young gassee. Mueller gets transferred again to the pits for the burning excess corpses, where he defies science by burning corpses without oxygen getting to them underneath, and by basting them in their melted fat. It is not, therefore, surprising that some of the more respectable peddlers of the Holocaust cult, known generally as exterminationists, have attempted to save face by condemning certain of the more extreme and outlandish claims. In The Final Solution, Gerald Rettlinger advises that, quote, "A certain degree of reserve is necessary in handling all this material, and particularly this applies to the last section of survivor narratives. The Eastern European Jew is a natural rhetorician, speaking in flowery similes, who uses numerals as oratorical adjectives, and whose very names are created of fantasy. In her book Eichmann in Jerusalem, Hannah Arendt reports that the prosecution had been under considerable pressure from Israeli survivors, who constitute about 20% of the present population of the country. They had flocked spontaneously to the trial authorities to offer themselves as witnesses. The worst cases of strong imagination people who had seen Eichmann at several places, various places where he had never been, were weeded out. But 56 sufferings of Jewish people, or witnesses, as the trial authorities called them, were finally put on the stand, instead of some 15 or 20 background witnesses as originally planned. If Eichmann's name was mentioned at all, it was obviously was hearsay evidence, rumors testified to. Hence, without legal validity, the testimony of all witnesses who had seen him with their own eyes collapsed the moment a question was addressed to them. In a remarkable climb-down British New Statesman of 2 November 1979, exterminationist scholar Gita Sereny admits it is true that along with some or with many authentic works, there have been books or films which were only partially true or even were completely faked. And unfortunately, even reputable historians often fail in their care by quoting supposed eyewitnesses who are in fact repeating hearsay. Martin Gilbert perpetuates errors which, because they are so easily disproved, provide revisionist opportunities. This is an area where which commercially motivated rubbish can have terrible long-term consequences. The problem with books like this is that they are ghosted by professional wordsmiths who have neither interest nor capacity to convey the truth or restraint. Worse again are the partial or complete fakes, such as Jean Francois Steiner's Treblinka or Martin Gray's For Those I Love. Steiner's book on the surface even seems right. He is a man of talent and conviction, and it's hard to know how he could go so wrong. But what he finally produced was a hodgepodge of truth and falsehood, libeling both the dead and the living. The original French book had to be withdrawn and reissued with all the names changed, but it retains its format of imagined conversations and reactions, i.e. pure fantasy, incredibly remaining nevertheless in serious bibliographies. Gray's For Those I Love was the work of Max Gallo, the ghostwriter. I myself told Gray that he had manifestly never been to nor escaped from Treblinka. He finally asked despairingly, but does it matter? Wasn't the only thing that Treblinka did happen that it should be written down, and that some Jews should be shown to have been heroic? In the same article, Mr. Sereny admits that Auschwitz, despite its emblematic name, was not primarily an extermination camp for Jews, and it's not the central case through which to study extermination policy. In a lengthy letter to the Los Angeles Times of 16 May 1981, Professor Deborah Lipstadt of UCLA History Department writes that the fact is that the Nazis never used the bodies of Jews, or, for that matter, anyone else, for the production of soap. The soap rumor was prevalent both during and after the war. It may have had its origins in the cadaver factory atrocity story that came out of World War I. The letters RJF probably stood for the name of the factory that produced the soap. The soap rumor was thoroughly investigated after the war and proved to be untrue. An article in Judaism of October 81, the same professor condemns the increased commercialization of the Holocaust. She warns that the separation of the Holocaust from the Jewish historical continuum is dangerous. She charged that Jewish leaders not only draw on the articulated sense of guilt that affects many of those who survived, but that they even try to create more guilt in order to make their flock more pliable and responsive. However, all this clutching at reality is beyond the intellectual ability of Eli Wiesel, chairman of the President's Commission, now Council on the Holocaust. In his 1980 report on the President, to the President, he described in much detail his neuroses. Why then cling to unbearable memories that may forever rob us of our sleep? Why not forget, turn the page, and proclaim, let it remain buried deep beneath the dark nightmares of our subconscious? Why not spare our children the weight of our collective burden and allow them to start their lives free of nocturnal obsessions and complexes, free of the Auschwitz and its shadows? Naturally, he immediately goes on to explain why we should suffer eternal insomnia. According to Wiesel, the survivors, quote, willingness to share their knowledge and their pain and their anguish, even their agony, is motivated solely by their convictions that their survival was for a purpose. A survivor sees himself as a messenger and a guardian of secrets entrusted by the dead. Yet again, the one crime that has visited and revisited Jewish children with monstrous regularity over the eons is described, quote, in order to cut expenses and save gas, cost accountant considerations led to an order to place living children directly into the ovens or throw them into the open burning pits. And yet again, the Holocaust kingdom is described in terms of charred souls, darkness, flames of darkness, fire, ashes, and torture. And right near the end of his report, a double whammy. Quote, little did we know that the Jewish children would again be murdered in cold blood by killers in Israel. Unquote. Yet another survivor in the same mold who obviously has not been keeping with all the revisions are being made to the Holocaust theory by leading exterminationists themselves is one Mel Mermelstein, author of the By Bread Alone. Mermelstein is the survivor who in 1981 sued the Institute for Historical Review for his $50,000 reward for proof of gas chambers. Yet again, burnt offerings are sent to the heavens. Quote, I turned my head, trying to dismiss the picture of the smoking chimneys and the fires below them, but the vision did not leave. It became worse inside me, and I realized that at the very moment my mother, Etu, Magda, Angel, and my playmate Karen might be in there, consumed by the flames. I looked up. I could barely see the sky. The picture became real. I screamed. Later, suddenly, the road burst upon the scene, a scene right out of Dante's Inferno, ahead of which three huge pits dug deep into the ground, and each a fire was raging around the flaming pits. Naked men were running in an endless circle. All around I could see SS guards and prison capos. Capos are Jews that help the guards, swinging their leather whips and driving the prisoners from behind into the pits. I kept pushing myself away from the pit, but something kept drawing me back. I was torn between two worlds, the living and the dead. I pushed my way closer to the edge of the pit. My God, I could see humans on fire, writhing and moaning. Again, there was no evidence whatsoever that the Germans engaged in any practice of emulating living persons. No documents, no photographs, no evidence that would stand up in court. All we have are the alleged eyewitness reports of people like Mermelstein, and we have seen in the Eichmann case and in a multitude of other war crimes trials, the eyewitness testimony in such cases is grossly unreliable. Every witness wants to be a star witness, regardless of the truth. At least we ought to be grateful that Mermelstein spares us the lurid details of sexual and toiletry nightmares. Last but not least, we come to the present-day turmoil in Israel, occupied Palestine. Here again, we find exactly the same symbolism in play. A report in the Los Angeles Times, dated 26 August 1979, describes the trial in Israel of two PLO members who allegedly attacked a civilian bus. According to the report, the two Arabs showed signs of having been beaten. One's arm was in a cast, the other's face was cut, and it had a black eye. And Mrs. Tesmil, defense counsel, said the prison guards had beaten him. The defense lawyer was harangued by both the prosecution witnesses and their spectators. Quote, "You sold out your country, you bitch, for PLO money," screamed one. Yet again, the witnesses drew on the usual imagery. When the girl terrorist grabbed the baby and threw it into the burning seat, we started to clap. Then I saw him shoot the boy and a man with glasses who said one word to him in Arabic. More abuse was heaped on the defense lawyer. Quote, "One of the male survivors of the massacre shouted at Mr. Tesmil, with whom he had gone to school, 'Your day will come too, Leah. Your children shall burn as others did.' Yes, indeed, your children should burn as others did. What is it about the sacred rite of the child sacrifice through immolation that purges the Jewish soul? After the Jews ridding themselves of some hereditary hang-up, or are providing themselves with a rationale to feel guilty for the rest of their lives, or might it not be that when his children are sacrificed as burnt offerings unto God, the Jew is vicariously destroying part of himself? Are the Jews so self-hating that they seek the destruction of their own prodigy?" The next part of the book that we'll go into later is called Why? Why is all this? What is it with these people? I think you pretty well figured out they're insane and they've passed their insanity along through Christianity to our white race. I must apologize. I'm not the greatest reader for something like this, that's for sure. But what I would like to see this, if nobody has done it before, they may have done it, put it in audio. We need somebody, if you can find it already been done, let me know. But this is a tremendous piece of information here from David McCollum. I can't stress too much how important this booklet is. Now, part of the reason my reading is not perfect, too, is because this booklet, the print, is very small and very close together. It's very difficult to read. But anyhow, if you know of an audio recording of this book around, let me know. If not, let's try to find ourselves a good reader that can put this on an MP3 file or something like that, because this is the kind of propaganda and information needs to get out, especially it's not that large of a book. It's concise, all of great facts are there, and all the research is there, and it's right there. I think it's really about all you need when it comes to the Jewish question. Well, let's see. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, and I think we'll probably have another Sling Blade show tomorrow. You have a good day, and let me see here. I might even pester you with another Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern song. I'll leave you have a break on Wednesday, but maybe Thursday I'll do it. I don't know. Okay. 14 words. Yep. Always. In 5 words, keep your mouth shut. I have nothing to say, man. You can bait me with a telephone book all you want. And you can be just like the CIA did in this latest release, that they're crying to the heavens that it's released because it shows all the rotten, nasty, terrible things that American taxpayers are financing through the CIA. And Kennedy was right when he wanted to get rid of the CIA. Bye-bye.
Is abundant. They call us pirates, but the only difference between them and us, they rob the poor under cover of law. We rob the rich under cover of nothing but our daring. They demand honor serving of us, knowing honor serving yields nothing but miserable wage for miserable labor. But it wonders, and there is satisfaction. There is pleasure and ease. And the only hazard we run for it is a sour look or two when they hang us. For a merry life. And a short one. And a rich one, too. Set all sails. Brace about. And fetch their course. 1,000 guns.
That is from the film Crossbones, a television series that I recommended you watch. I have quite an affinity for the pirates, the privateers of old, because they cut themselves loose from the kings and so forth, and they did it on their own. And they were pretty democratic, too. They voted for their operations, and I've always liked the Skull and Crossbones. In fact, to be perfectly honest and don't want to offend anybody, but I prefer the Skull and Crossbones to the swastika myself. See you later.